Just kind of a practical question. As a breeder producing bulls interested in feed efficiency, should I invest in individual feed measurements for my bulls, or should I wait on DNA testing?
Do you want to address that to the whole panel, or is there a particular speaker?
Anybody that wants to take it on.
What was the last part of the question? So,
whether I should invest in individual feed management systems such as GrowSafe, or should I wait on this technology to measure the feed efficiency through genotyping?
Yeah. So the big issue there is that everything that we've done in Missouri to this point is based on a sample of 700 steers. And I think the message that you should have got from the presentations this morning are that to get those accuracy levels up where we need them, we really need much bigger populations than that. I'm interested in trying to work collaboratively with other groups that have got cattle that they have genotyped and phenotyped for feed efficiency. If we can pull those data and do the analyses that I showed this morning, I think we can get those accuracies up to the point that they're going to be valuable to you. But for now, I wouldn't stop recording intakes.
I won't answer that directly because I don't know how much it costs to record food intake. But for back home, most producers have decided that it's just too expensive. There's another answer, though, to this question, is that the DNA technology will service all the traits at once. It's not sort of trait specific. You know, eventually you'll buy a service from a company which produces genomic EPDs for a whole set of traits, and net food intake will be one of many traits, so that there won't be a decision about do I get markers on a trait by trait basis. You'll just get them for everything.
Okay, I know the...
Our first three speakers today all talked about how this has specifications and works very well for within breed evaluations. Kent, this would be a question for you, but the others may want to jump in. How then do we handle the ever-increasing number of hybrids and composites we have, the Limi Flexes and so on?
That really is a better question for these guys, because I don't really know. I'm hopeful that they will evolve the technology such that it's robust across purebred and hybrid types. And I'm hoping that given the work in Angus, because of the size of that population, it'll be especially informative to all of our Angus-based derivatives. And for what the Continental or the Boss Indicus influence represents, we need to work hard to make sure we develop the repositories so that they can do discovery and validation there.
Yeah, it's actually possible to take these genotypes that have been produced in hybrid animals and identify along the chromosomes where that piece of DNA came from. We've done this in various populations now, and you can actually go in and say, oh, okay, this piece of this chromosome came from Angus, and then the next piece came from Brahman, and then the next piece came from a Simmental, and or you can establish that with high degrees of probability. I think that sort of approach is the approach that we're going to need to take if we're genotyping hybrid animals. And I think that when we get to that point, we may need to have a higher density assay than we have right now, as some of us have alluded to. But work is progressing. You know, one of the big problems we've got is that Dorian just pointed out that he gets these data sets with 50 million genotypes in them. My data set is 1.5 billion genotypes. I just spent $20,000 on a computer and drives to just store the data that we've generated. And the problem is that the amount of work that is required to do what Dorian has shown is really, really very substantive. So we're at the point right now that we've got more data than we've got people to actually analyze those data and get these results out. But all I can say right now is that we have the populations, we've got them genotyped, we've got phenotypes, it will get figured out. We may be a year or two away.
I think just a sort of general response to Bob's question, looking a little bit wider, what we find generally is that when we do an analysis in a discovery population and we try and see how well it works in a target population, the accuracy in the target population declines the bigger the distance, genetic distance, between the target and the training population. So within a breed, if you've got similar families, if you like, in your target population, it works very well. When you get less related animals, it tends to work not quite as well. So when you go to something like a composite or a first cross, it's getting even less related still. So I would expect it to erode the further away it gets from the training population. And part of that is a problem due to linkage disequilibrium, and part of it may be due to dominance, nephrostasis, and other kinds of things. So the safest way to fix that problem is to make sure that some of the kinds of animals that you are intending to target get used in your training populations. So if you want to use it in composites, get some of those composites into the training population. Mike talked quite a lot about dairy issues. In New Zealand, they do a crossbreed genomic predictions, but they train on data sets that include purebred or straightbred Holstein Friesian bulls, straightbred Jersey bulls, and crossbred bulls. And they get predictions that stand up across those breeds and crosses, provided their training data set includes all of those breeds and crosses in it.
Yes, I'd just like to ask all the speakers, if you consider turning the tables and each one of you owned 500 cows and you derived 100% of your income from the sale of registered seed stock, and considering the status of genomic testing as we now know it and looking 3 years down the road, what are the specific steps you would take to ensure your viability over the next 10 years?
Get a job at a university.
Yeah, and if you can tell me how to fix my 401k, I can plan for the next 10 years too.
But I think it's a very interesting question, and the message that I've been giving to people is that this really is going to be a revolution. I know we've been promising you this for years and not delivering, and I'm acutely aware of our failure, but you've just got to look at what's happening in dairy to see that this really is working now. The whole world's dairy breeding programs are switching over to genomic selection with dramatic changes in the structure of their progeny testing and everything else. So you've got to be cautious. You don't want to invest money too soon, but you've got to be looking to see how you can make use of this, because I really think that the people who don't make use of it, in 10 years' time, they will have a hobby rather than a business. And one of the answers might be that instead of having 500 cows that breed bulls, that you go for 2,000. And you see how the technology will enable you to run a much bigger operation and to therefore cut your costs and to sell a product that's both good and cheap. Another possibility is to look to drive the integration with the people later down the value chain yourself, so that you're not dictated terms to by people who have got big corporations and suddenly see the power to influence a part of their supply chain. So, you know, these are big questions. I'm not pretending I've got all the answers, but it really is going to change the world.
Brian, I know your question was, what should you do? I would switch that around a little bit and say I would have a little feedback on what you should not do. Please do not discontinue collecting and submitting phenotypic records on all the traits for which your performance programs go. I think for the time being, I'd even step up my efforts as to collecting traditional information and getting it submitted. Second thing I would do, though, is I'd really think about capturing and storing DNA on important animals in my herd for future reference.
I have a question.
Can I just jump in and just add one more thing to that? Kent already brought up a really key issue with this technology, and that is that you can genotype any animal and come up with an accuracy that's determined by the test, which means that we're going to be looking at herd bulls, we're going to be young bulls, we're going to be looking at females that can be genotyped, and you can come up with EPDs that have far greater accuracies than you currently have to manage your herds. If I were doing this, and I know what's happening in the dairy industry, what's happening in the dairy industry is people are going around figuring out how they can cost effectively genotype females. So the 384 SNP test that we talked about here today in the dairy industry, they're building a 384 SNP test for net merit, and they're going to go around and genotype a whole bunch of cows. Why are they going to do that? Because then they can, regardless of the lineage, the pedigree that these animals come from, they can identify the very best females in the population that they can use to breed the next generation of young bulls. So think about it from that perspective. Think about what can you do to increase the amount of information that you have on the cows that you're managing, which is a big part of it, because you're now talking about being able to make just as much improvement on the female side as on the male side if you can get the turnover. So I'd maybe genotype my neighbor's heifers and figure out which are the best ones and then offer him a low-ball price for him before he figures it out for himself.
I have a question regarding what we should do over the next year. First of all, I thought this was a great morning session. I was really pleased to see what's come out of the 1 year of work, in a sense, if you think about how long we've had this panel. I heard that we need more SNPs, and there's an effort, Jerry, you commented, that's on its way to do that. Is this on?
I don't think it's on, John. I can barely hear you.
Hello?
Oh, that's better.
You mentioned this morning, very uncomfortable. You mentioned this morning that we have an effort going forth to get a large SNP panel in place. Mike, you mentioned getting more data. Those are things that we can work towards. But what I also heard was building repositories across breeds, and that's something that we can do. But let me ask you this. We in a sense, have used a tremendous resource in the Angus population almost to its capacity. Is that right? And we did explain exciting amounts of variation. And so my question is, how do we take that resource where we've actually exploited the low-hanging fruit, as we often hear talked about, and get a few more percentages out of that particular breed? Because the other breeds are by nature smaller, and we're going to have strategies once we get to that point to continue to raise that up.
Yeah, John, I think we need a two-pronged approach. You're right, we've made a lot of progress in the last year, but there is still no markers on the market that I know of that have been discovered through 50K panel results. So we researchers and we genomics companies that have paid for discovery populations and provided us data to analyze, we've come up with things that technically work better. But there's no bull breeder in the room yet who has been able to take advantage of any of those things. So to me, the first prong needs to be to get out there what we have now that actually works. So get some panels out that use the better SNPs that have been identified off the 50K panel, and that's really a job for the genomics companies to decide which SNPs and which traits and how big's the panels and what they might cost. So I don't think we want to lose sight of the fact that actually needs to happen, because we haven't made any ground shift yet because they haven't been available. On the research side, to me what we need to be doing is trying to get that correlation between predicted genomic merit and performance in a validation population going up annually, just like we see genetic trends going up annually. So I showed results today that said 0.4, 0.5, 0.6 kind of numbers. What we would hope is that in 24 months' time, we'll see those numbers getting up into the 0.5s and 6s and 7s and 8s and so on. And to do that, we are going to need denser panels because the linkage disequilibrium on the 50K panel is not great enough. But I don't think we should delay implementation while we go away and develop a higher panel. But we will need a denser panel. We will need to start thinking about how we use sequence data. And we will need more populations, particularly of other breeds and other environments, to do more training and more validation. So to me, it's just going to be more of the same like we've done in the past. We're going to have to breed animals, we're going to have to collect their information, and we're going to have to add it to evaluations. Instead of being national cattle evaluations, it's going to be discovery processes with more dense markers. We've got to do all of those things and hope that each year we can make successive improvements to the technology.
Going a little further with that, then how, when you get to the other breeds, or any breeds for that matter, what are the amount of total samplings that you need? And Dr. Taylor brought up, bring a semen in. Is semen the only test you can do? Can we do hair? Can we do notched ears? We need a little bit more specifics if we're going to do that. And two, how do we coordinate as one of the other breeds in order to get that into the system so the testing can be done on that?
Yeah, I mentioned semen simply, well, for two reasons. First of all, bulls tend to have higher accuracies of EPDs in the databases. So if you go to the Angus Association database and you pull up males and females, you just tend to get higher accuracies because there are more progeny out of bulls that get phenotypes. So when we build these discovery populations, you really want to have populations in which the accuracies of the EPDs that you're using are pretty substantial. And it's interesting that, for example, in that population of 1,700 Angus bulls, if you look at the carcass trait EPDs on those bulls and look at the average accuracy on them, they're only about 40% anyway. And what we're showing you today is that, you know, with something in the vicinity of 384 markers, we can get to the same level of accuracy as the average bull has that. So one of the issues is going to be making sure that the animals that get into those repositories have high quality data. Now that could be phenotypes, but if it's EPDs, you want to make sure that they have reasonable accuracies. They're the sort of animals you want to target. If they're males, it doesn't really matter where the DNA comes from. You can get lots of DNA out of hair roots. You can get it out of nasal swabs. We've also done the nasal swab. That's actually pretty easy. You can just put the nasal swab on an FTA card, and you can just store it away till you want to use it. So any route by which those DNA samples can be acquired and stored, I think is just fine. But you do want to make sure that the animals that you're sampling ultimately end up having decent phenotypes. That's when they're going to become useful. Put them together. The nasal swabs are good because when they end up coming to wherever the repository is, you don't have problems with having to process them like you do if you have blood or if you have an ear notch or something like that. You've got to worry about getting them processed. When you come in with a nasal swab or a store of semen, you can just store it immediately and keep it till you need it.
Just one other comment. I don't know if Harvey Blackburn is here or not. Is Harvey around? But the USDA, Harvey runs a USDA program in Fort Collins where they have responsibility to store DNA, so in the event of some kind of a disaster, they could resurrect germplasm. They have responsibility to do it across all animal and plant species, so they have lots of nitrogen tanks and they have database systems to store data along with the DNA. And I know at Iowa State we had a lot of semen tanks of bulls that we used in research in the past that we didn't really want to store, but it seemed a shame to throw it away. Well, Harvey's taken some of that, or will take some of that, and have it a portfolio of that material available for any researcher who might want it in the future. And I believe some of the breeds, the Breed Association execs, have already worked with Harvey to make sure that some of their sires are represented. And presumably that laboratory would store tissue samples as well as DNA such as semen. Certainly in the case of plants, they've got both seeds and they've got cuttings of many plants. So if Harvey's here, he might want to comment.
Relative to your other breed question, I would just point out that the Meat Animal Research Center is currently in the midst of the 2000 bull project, and the National Beef Cattle Evaluation Consortium is in the midst of initiating the growth trait project, and these are all multi-breed efforts that will help disseminate this technology, I think, throughout all the major populations.
Just a follow-up on that. Can you give me a number? Are we talking 2,000 samples, 5,000, 10,000? I mean, what's your base? What do you have in order to set, Dr. Taylor, I think you said something about 7,000 earlier. Is that the group's opinion that the 7,000 is a magic number in order to get enough to get your base started on a breed?
I think when we go to a crossbreed, it's going to be most important for a crossbreed analysis. So when we want to develop markers that will work right across different breeds, we're going to have a large number of breeds represented and a reasonably large sample from each breed. And I think the number is probably going to be a lot less than that. So if we can put together, 800 individuals within a breed, but then we can do that across 10 breeds or more, we're at the point where we've got, I think, large enough samples that we can do the analyses. So if you're not the most numerous breed in the United States and your registrations are not that high, it doesn't mean you're going to get excluded from the process. It's going to take a little more time perhaps to gather up the number of animals, but we can use them. I mean, if you can go out and round up 300 or 400 bulls this week and get the DNA into the system, we can get it genotyped and we can start moving towards the multiple breed analysis.
Just the bulls, or can we bring in
the cows? If you've got cows, so the limousine population that I'm genotyping actually is an interesting example of that. This is the animals that were sent to Gary Johnson at the University of Missouri for testing for protopurpuria. And we basically, what we did was got the database, the NALF gave us the database for all these animals. And what we did was went through and we pulled up all the EPDs on these animals and we said, okay, let's go to the carcass traits because that's where we've got the least information. Let's sort them on marbling accuracy. And anything that's got a marbling accuracy of greater than, I think, 15%, we'll include in the analysis. That let us pull 2,300 animals out of that database. Now, there's females in there. So there's both males and females in there. But the important thing is that if you want to build a model that will predict marbling, you've got to have data on marbling accuracy with reasonable accuracies. So we pulled those animals out. We've got the 2,300 lineages that we need. We've genotyped about half of them. The other half will be done within about a month.
Hi.
I don't think there's an absolute number for how many you need. Obviously, the more animals you have in the discovery population, the more accurate you'll get your predictions of breeding value. We've got some reasonable results with having 1,000 bulls in our discovery population, but my rule of thumb is that if you're going to use individual phenotypes instead of progeny tested bulls, you need about four times as many. So that would translate to something like 4,000 steer records. So, it is going to be a challenge to get the numbers of records, especially for smaller breeds. The only thing I can say is that you need to try. The bigger numbers that you get, the more useful it will be to you.
Hi, Albert Pashek, Tyson Foods. Bill from Cargill Meat Solutions. I'd like to
ask you if you could share perhaps some optimistic numbers. I'm very glad to see that system is working, marker-assisted management system is working in your system. I take part responsibility for it. Can you give us some numerical economic numbers? What are you seeing in your system, what some folks here could hope for? That would be the best input. Second question, pardon me, I'd like Dr. Mike Goddard maybe help us here. Mike, could you please think about Australia, Australian beef production system? I don't want to compare anything between US or Australian systems, but if you focus only on Australian system, do you have dreams, goals, aims, how much value actually through these new technologies you're aiming for to create for cattle producer, beef producer in Australia? Is there any rule of thumb or percentage or ratio that could help? What needs to be done in order for producers to experience that value and capture it, and technology providers to survive?
As for the economic impact that we're kind of seeing, just ballpark about 2-to-1 return on investment, with the test being about $10. We'll likely see that push up to 3-to-1 return on investment as we see testing costs come down due to improvements in technology and also optimization of the use of the technology in the production environment.
I haven't got a good cost-benefit analysis right off the top of my head, but the Beef CRC, when it got its funding, promised that we would deliver a range of technologies which would be worth $200 million a year to the beef industry. So we're thinking in reasonably large numbers. I think it's possible that we could double the rate of genetic improvement by the use of this technology. Not today we couldn't, but in 10 years' time. So whatever you think genetic improvement is worth today, double it.
As a seed stock breeder, I've got a question. You indicated on a best case scenario, there was about a 70% correlation in marbling. As a seed stock breeder, what would my correlation be if I sent you 3 samples from 3 different genomics companies? Would it increase it, or would it stay the same? Because I'm assuming that they're not all using the same stems.
Yeah, so if the MBVs used by each genomics company have different markers in them, maybe some of them are the same, but if some of them are different, then each extra MBV will add a bit more information than you had before. So incorporating all of them in the evaluation system, you would expect to be a little bit more accurate than just using any one of them. And there is some work in progress. Steve Catchman has done some work looking at technically how he would go about developing a system that could use all of those MBVs. But obviously there will be a diminishing return once you've paid for the first test. The second test is going to have less return on investment than it would have had if it was the first test you were doing. Does that make sense to you, Dave?
I think this points out why it's so important that our industry be able to publish the effects of these various traits, most likely in biological terms, so that the industry can decide which company, in fact, is delivering the most effects for the money. And I think that if we really, really want to sell this to the industry, we've got to move as quickly as we can is to incorporate these into our existing EPDs on the trace we already have and put those in effect so we can measure the economics of it.
So, Dave, I'm assuming by effects you mean the effect of the panel, not the effect of the individual mark. You're talking about the cumulative effect of the panel, but in units of the trait, so in units of marbling score, for instance.
Yes, my question deals with the adoption of this technology. Is there a risk associated with encouraging single trait selection, of which we know is detrimental, particularly to the desert range environment, when we need to consider the maternal cow, and if we're concentrating on the carcass side of the equation, in the adoption of this technology, encouraging that single trait selection with high accuracies brought on by this technology?
I mean, my guess would be the reverse, that these companies are going to come up with panels that do a number of traits, so you're going to have a problem of more traits to choose from rather than less traits. Maybe Kent would like to follow up on that.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you, but this technology will empower you to do greater single trait selection than ever before and suffer greater adverse consequences for antagonistically related traits than ever before. But I would think that the enablement of evaluation of a whole new suite of traits, such as feed efficiency, perhaps disease resistance, immune response, healthfulness of beef, even the suite of traits dealing with adaptability, maternal adaptability, fertility, lifetime production, that's part of the One MBCEC project, will probably take us in the direction away from single trait selection.
I agree with both of those answers, but I think there was an important point in your question, which was specifically about fertility or reproductive traits. And I think there is a danger there, because a trait like, say, calving percentage is lowly heritable. We seldom get good progeny test results on bulls, and if we're going to record it, use the cows themselves in the discovery population, then we need a very large number of cows. So I think we ought to put our minds a little bit to what to do about fertility traits. They're going to be hard, but they're clearly economically important, and we don't want them to get left out in this.
Any more questions at this time? I'd take one more if there's one there. Otherwise, I think we're going to... Oh, okay. Jerry's going to make one final point, and then Dorian was going to have a wrap-up of the session and a summary. I can't see my mic, people, but there are... We good? All right.
One more question.
Okay. One more question. All right.
What efforts are in place to balance out the advancements in the genetic side with, you know, there's limited time resources, limited financial resources, how are we balancing out decision on the decision support side to help producers make the decisions with all the advancements we're seeing on the genetics? And I know we've had a lot of discussion with past BIF meetings about economically relevant traits and the need for decision support software. Is there enough research going into those efforts complement all the work that's being done on the genetic side?
You can if you like.
No, you can do it.
I mean, right at the moment there is very little work being done on decision support, but having said that, if the MBVs get incorporated into an EPD, we do have decision support systems that use EPDs, so they could automatically take advantage of the MBV enhanced EPDs without any real change. We don't have any decision support systems for feedlot parts of the system. We've really only got them for cow calf systems. So yes, there's the opportunity to do a lot more work there. But rightly or wrongly at the moment, most of our activity have been focused on how to get better predictions. If you look over the years, there's been an enormous amount of work being done on decision support, principally in the form of trying to generate indexes, and for whatever reason, they have been poorly adopted by the industry. So at the moment, we're focusing on the genetic prediction side, which we expect will be much more rapidly adopted, but maybe when we get those that portfolio of enhanced EPDs, it will be the proper time to get them in the decision support system.
So I just realised that I neglected to tell you something that was rather important that I think pertains to some of the discussion that we had here. A lot of the work that you've seen presented here, certainly a lot of the stuff in my lab, but the building of this chip, the genotyping, has all been supported by the USDA CSIRES. And Pete Berfninger is here in the room today. And I need to give them, the USDA, a lot of credit for where this industry's got to very, very rapidly. But they also have ongoing grants in this area that's going to support this as we go forward. Allison has a grant, and Dorian has a grant, and there's another actually very substantive grant that John Pollock and I and Kurt Van Tassel have funded through the new version of the agency, the AFRI, to implement this technology in the beef industry. And that grant has got about 3 years to run. It's about $1.7 million. And under that grant, we actually have money in there to do genotyping in some of these breeds other than Angus that have been highly represented. So if there are people out there that are very, you know, eager to get their breeds represented in this technology, and you can collect the DNA samples and you can get them to us, me in particular, at Missouri, we probably are going to be able to find enough money in that grant to genotype 2,000 or 3,000 individuals from breeds that are not well represented. So it's an opportunity for you. You know, I think Mike has pointed out how important it is that you try to get involved in this, try to get vested. If you can get vested and get the samples to us, we can get a lot of them genotyped, and you can, you know, it'll advance us as we try to get tests in the marketplace that work right across breeds. Thank you.
Okay, so Allison asked me to make a few